Welcome back, everybody, to another deep dive. This time we're tackling chapter 13, and it's all about persuasive speaking.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, it's funny. It's like we're always on the receiving end of persuasion,
right?
Whether we realize it or not. Think about those social media ads you're scrolling through.
Mm-hmm.
They're always trying to convince us to buy the next thing that we don't need.
That's true. Yeah. Persuasion is everywhere.
Hmm.
But, you know, in this chapter, we're really focused on the kind that you would use when you're giving a speech.
Right.
And that's often about tackling some kind of community problem or advocating for some change or engaging with really difficult conversations about issues that impact all of us.
For sure. So let's jump right into it.
Yeah.
The textbook defines persuasion as the process of creating, reinforcing, or changing people's beliefs or actions.
Okay.
Seems like a lot to unpack there. What do you think?
Yeah, there is. And it's important to remember that persuasion in public speaking, it's not about manipulating people.
Right.
It's about engaging with them in a very meaningful way about issues that really matter. Think of it as like a way to tackle public controversies.
Right.
Those issues that we debate about, you know,
no.
They impact a lot of people. They involve all kinds of different perspectives.
Oh, so it's not like you're just taking a side and just arguing blindly for it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's much more nuanced than that. It's about understanding the context, the different perspectives that are involved, and even the power dynamics at play.
Okay.
So like choosing a topic for your persuasive speech, it means thinking critically about how your advocacy might empower or disempower different groups within a community.
That makes sense. But how do you know if you're like accidentally disempowering someone with your argument?
Right.
It seems like that could be a difficult thing to assess.
It can be, yeah. Yeah. So let's say, for instance, you're giving a speech and you are advocating against a landfill being built in your neighborhood.
Okay.
On the surface, that seems like a very reasonable position to take.
Yeah.
Who wants a landfill in their backyard? But what if by opposing the landfill in your neighborhood, you're simply shifting the burden to a more vulnerable community that doesn't have the resources to fight back?
That's a really good point. So how do you avoid those kinds of pitfalls then?
Yeah, it's tough. By being reflexive. Do your research and truly listen to different perspectives.
Okay.
It's about recognizing that even well-intentioned advocacy can have unintended consequences if we don't consider the broader impact of our arguments.
Absolutely. So now that we've kind of like set the stage in terms of like what persuasion is and why it matters,
mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how we actually go about constructing a persuasive argument.
Okay.
So the textbook breaks this down into three types of persuasive propositions.
Right.
Propositions of fact, propositions of value, and propositions of policy.
Yep.
So let's start with propositions of fact.
Okay.
Now, these aren't like just stating obvious facts, right?
Yeah.
Like the sky is blue.
Right. They're more like debatable claims that you have to back up with evidence. So think about it like, you know, in your history class, you might be asked to write a paper arguing that a particular event had a very specific cause.
Mm-hmm.
That's a proposition of fact.
Okay.
You're making a claim, but it has to be supported with historical evidence.
So like instead of just saying like the American Revolution was caused by British taxes,
yeah,
you would actually have to like go and show the evidence.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's not even enough to just present those facts.
Okay.
You also have to explain why those facts matter to the audience. Why should they care about whatever the cause of the American Revolution was?
Right.
Or how they connect to the larger issue.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Okay.
So what about propositions of value? Those sound a little bit more, I don't know, subjective.
They are. Propositions of value are all about arguing about what is good or bad, right or wrong. Think about debates around, let's say, universal health care or the death penalty.
Yeah.
These are issues where people's values really come into play.
So how do you persuade someone who has completely different values than you?
That is a really good question.
Yeah.
It's definitely a challenge. First, you have to actually define the values that you're using. What do you mean by good or bad in the context of this argument?
Okay.
And then you need to find common ground with your audience. So appeal to the values that you might actually share, even if your conclusions differ.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm giving a speech about why I think college tuition should be free.
Okay.
That seems like a pretty hot button issue where people have strong opinions.
Yeah.
On both sides.
It is. And that actually brings us to propositions of policy.
Okay.
Propositions of policy advocate for a specific course of action.
All right.
They often involve that should language.
Okay.
We should do this or they should do that. Your proposition that college tuition should be free That's a great example of a proposition of policy.
Right. And those often come with like a call to action, right? Like,
yes.
Sign this petition or contact your representatives.
Exactly. You're not just trying to change people's minds. You're really trying to get them to do something.
Totally. So let's say I'm giving that speech about free college tuition. How would I even go about organizing it to be the most persuasive?
Well, one very common approach is called the problem-solution pattern.
Okay.
So you start by establishing a need for change. You highlight all the problems with the current system of college tuition.
Okay.
And then you present your solution. Make college free.
That seems pretty straightforward. Now, the textbook also mentions this thing called Monroe's motivated sequence.
Yes.
And it sounds kind of, I don't know, intense.
It's a good one.
Can you break that down for us?
Yeah. So it's actually a really effective way to organize a persuasive speech, especially when you're advocating for specific action. So it's a five-step process that starts with getting the audience's attention.
Okay.
Think about it like the hook in a song or the opening scene of a movie.
Got it.
You want to draw them in and make them want to hear more.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
Okay. So you grab their attention and then you establish the need.
Okay.
So you lay out the problem. Make the audience really feel how urgent this is and how relevant it is to their own lives. Why is this problem important? Why should they care about it?
So, like, if I'm doing my free college tuition speech, I might start off by sharing a personal story.
Sure.
About, like, struggling to pay for college myself.
Yeah.
Or I could talk about just the rising cost of tuition and how it's preventing people from going to college.
Exactly. You want to connect that problem to their own values and their own experiences. And then you move to the satisfaction step where you present your solution.
Okay.
So in your case, you would explain how making college tuition free would address all those problems that you just outlined.
This is making sense now.
Mm.
What are the last two steps?
All right. So the fourth step is visualization.
Okay.
This is where you get to paint a picture of the future with or without your solution.
Okay.
So what will happen if college tuition continues to be so expensive? What would the future look like if we just made it free?
So I might talk about the benefits of having like a more educated workforce.
Yeah.
Or the economic opportunities that could open up for people.
Sure.
Who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford college.
Or you could talk about the negative side, right? What if only wealthy people can afford college?
Right.
And then that creates more social and economic inequality.
Gotcha. So last step, action.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, action. This is where you tell the audience exactly what they can do to be a part of the solution. Do you want them to sign a petition? Do you want them to contact their representatives? Do you want them to donate to a scholarship fund?
Yeah.
Give them very concrete steps that they can take right away.
Okay, this motivated sequence is starting to feel like, I don't know, like a secret weapon or something.
It can be really effective when used well. But remember, it's not about manipulating people. It's about presenting your argument in a way that's clear and compelling and inspires action.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, speaking of the audience, it seems like knowing where they stand on an issue is pretty crucial. How do you figure that out?
So that's where this idea of the persuasive continuum comes in.
Okay.
It's this visual scale that can help you figure out where your audience falls on a spectrum of, you know, strongly disagree to strongly agree.
So like for my free college tuition speech,
mm-hmm.
I would have to think about, okay, how many people in the audience are already going to be like diehard supporters?
Right.
How many are totally opposed and how many are somewhere in between?
Exactly. And the beauty of that tool is it helps you visualize your goals a little bit.
Okay.
You might not be able to convince everyone to completely agree with you, but maybe you can move them just a little bit closer to your side.
Right. So it's about setting like realistic goals
mm-hmm.
and recognizing that any movement like towards agreement
yeah.
is a win in itself.
Absolutely.
But it also seems like people can be pretty resistant to change,
mm-hmm.
even when they're presented with a really good argument.
That's true, yeah. We as humans, we tend to gravitate towards information that confirms our existing beliefs. Even if those beliefs are not totally accurate or even beneficial, it's this phenomenon called selective exposure.
It's kind of like how people only get their news from sources
yeah.
that already agree with their political views.
Exactly. Exactly. And when we are confronted with information that actually challenges those beliefs, it can create what psychologists call cognitive dissonance.
That sounds uncomfortable.
It can be. It's that icky feeling of discomfort we experience when we're holding two conflicting beliefs or when our actions don't align with our values.
Okay.
And to resolve that discomfort, what we often do is double down on our existing beliefs, even if the evidence suggests that we should reconsider.
It's like when you see people who refuse to wear seatbelts.
Yes.
Even though it's like statistically proven they save lives.
That's a perfect example.
It's like, why?
So how do we as persuasive speakers overcome this resistance to change?
Yeah, that's the big question,
It
right?
is.
I'm guessing like you don't start off by just telling someone they're wrong and they need to change their entire worldview.
Probably not the best approach. No. Instead, the textbook suggests starting with reasonable requests.
Okay.
Don't try to get someone to do like a complete 180 right away. Focus on smaller, more achievable steps that align with their existing beliefs and values.
So like with the seatbelt example, instead of trying to convince someone that like seatbelts are the best invention ever,
Yeah.
maybe I start by asking them to consider wearing one on like long trips or
Exactly.
when driving at night.
You're meeting them where they are and proposing a smaller change that's less likely to trigger that cognitive dissonance.
Okay, so meet them where they are. That's a good strategy. What else can we do to make our persuasive appeals more effective?
The textbook also emphasizes the importance of really highlighting the benefits and consequences of taking or not taking a particular action.
So I could point out how wearing a seatbelt could protect my friend from getting hurt in an accident.
Yes.
Or talk about, the legal or financial consequences of not wearing one.
Exactly. By framing the issue in terms of potential gains or losses, you're appealing to their desire for positive outcomes and also their aversion to negative ones.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this all kind of comes together now.
Good.
Is there anything else we should be keeping in mind when we're like crafting these persuasive appeals?
Yes, one more crucial point. Always anticipate and address those oppositional arguments.
Okay.
Don't pretend they don't exist. Acknowledge them head on and offer really compelling rebuttals.
So if my friend says, "Well, I'm a good driver, I don't need a seatbelt," I could counter that with statistics
Yes.
showing that accidents can happen to anyone.
Exactly. By addressing those yeah buts,
Right.
you demonstrate that you've considered different perspectives and you're prepared to engage with them in a thoughtful way.
This is all really helpful. So we've talked about types of propositions,
Yeah.
organizing our arguments, understanding the audience, overcoming that resistance to change. What's next on our persuasive speaking journey?
But we need to talk about the importance of avoiding logical fallacies. These are errors in reasoning that can weaken our arguments and make us look less credible.
Oh, I've definitely heard of those, but I could use a refresher,
Okay.
like what they are and how to avoid them.
Let's dive into that in the next part of our deep dive. Okay, so let's tackle those logical fallacies. You can think of them kind of like little traps in your reasoning.
Okay.
They might sound convincing at first, but if you look closely, they're based on faulty logic.
I'm ready to avoid those traps. Where do we begin?
All right, so let's start with a really common one called the false cause fallacy.
Okay.
This happens when someone assumes that just because one event happened before another, the first event actually caused the second.
Oh, I think I do that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I wore my lucky shirt and aced my exam.
Right.
Therefore, the shirt caused me to ace the exam.
Exactly. It's so tempting to like see these connections where they
Loudly.
might not exist. In reality, your hard work and studying probably had more to do with your exam success than the shirt you were wearing.
Probably, yeah. Okay, what about the slippery slope fallacy? I feel like I hear that one a lot, especially when people are talking about politics.
Yes, the slippery slope, a classic. It's when you argue that one action will inevitably lead to like a whole chain of negative consequences.
Right.
Even though there's really not enough evidence to support that claim.
It's like saying if we allow students to use calculators in math class, they'll never learn to do basic arithmetic.
Right.
And then they won't be able to like balance a checkbook and then the whole economy will collapse.
A little dramatic, don't you think?
Maybe a bit, yeah.
Okay, so we've got the false cause, the slippery slope.
Yep.
What's next? How about the hasty generalization?
Okay.
This fallacy happens when you make a sweeping statement.
Okay.
But it's based on just a few examples or like a limited
So
experience.
it's like saying all college professors are boring lecturers just because you had one who put you to sleep.
Exactly. You can't judge an entire group of people based on just one experience.
I'm noticing a pattern here. It seems like a lot of these fallacies come from like jumping to conclusions
Yes.
without enough evidence.
That is a very insightful observation. You're absolutely right. Critical thinking is all about evaluating the evidence and considering all those different perspectives before forming an opinion.
So what about the straw person fallacy? That one sounds kind of interesting.
Okay, so the straw person fallacy involves misrepresenting your opponent's argument to make it easier to attack. It's like you're setting up a straw person and then knocking it down rather than engaging with their actual argument.
So instead of like addressing the real complexities of a policy proposal, I might just oversimplify my opponent's position.
Yeah.
And then just attack that oversimplification.
Exactly. It's a way to avoid an actual debate, and instead you just attack this distorted version of what they're actually arguing.
Seems pretty unfair when you put it that way.
It is. It's important to be able to recognize this tactic.
Right.
Both in other people's arguments, but also be mindful of it in your own thinking.
For sure. Okay, so we've got false cause, slippery slope, hasty generalization, and straw person. Anything else we should look out for?
Yeah, a few more. Let's talk about the false dilemma fallacy.
Okay.
This one occurs when someone presents only two options, like there are no other alternatives.
Oh, is that like the either-or fallacy?
Yes, it is. It's often presented as a choice between two extremes.
Okay.
Like, one is desirable, the other one is disastrous.
So it's like saying you're either for stricter gun control or you want to see people die.
Exactly. It completely ignores the possibility of compromise or nuance or other solutions.
Wow. Okay. So we've covered a lot of fallacies already. Are there any more we need to add to our list?
Just a few more that are important to mention. There's the appeal to tradition fallacy, which argues that something is good or right because it's always been done that way.
Oh, like we should keep using this old textbook because it's the one we've always used.
Right.
But just because something is a tradition doesn't mean it's the best option.
Exactly. We should always be open to new ideas and approaches.
Good point. What about the bandwagon fallacy? That one feels pretty relevant today with social media and all.
Oh, absolutely. The bandwagon fallacy basically argues that something must be true or good simply because a lot of people believe it or do it.
It's like everyone's buying this new phone, so it must be amazing.
Right, but popularity doesn't equal quality or truth.
True.
Think about all those fads and trends that were popular for a minute and then disappeared.
Right, okay. What about the red herring fallacy? I feel like that name is, I don't know, a little fishy.
It is. It's a distraction tactic. Basically, you're introducing a totally irrelevant topic to divert attention away from the main argument.
So if I'm debating someone about climate change and they start talking about the national debt,
that's a red herring. It's important to be able to recognize those distractions and bring the focus back to the core issue.
Okay, so stay focused. Got it. Last but not least, what about the ad hominem fallacy? I see that one all the time online, it feels like.
Unfortunately, yes. Ad hominem is Latin for to the person. So this fallacy involves attacking the person making the argument instead of actually addressing the argument itself.
Ah, so instead of like engaging with someone's ideas, you attack like their character or their appearance or their background.
Exactly. It's basically a way to just discredit someone and dismiss their argument without having to actually engage with what they're saying.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very productive.
Not at all. It's a cheap shot and a sign of weak reasoning.
Okay, so we've learned about a whole bunch of fallacies. How do we make sure we're not falling into these traps ourselves?
The key is awareness.
Okay.
You know your common fallacies and you have to practice critical thinking. Before you present any argument, ask yourself, is this based on solid evidence?
Right.
Have I considered different perspectives? Am I being fetter to my opponent's argument?
That's great advice. And it seems like knowing these fallacies could also help us just be better listeners.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, just better consumers of information in general.
Yeah. In today's world, we are bombarded with information constantly. It's more important than ever to be able to critically evaluate these messages that we're receiving and spot those red flags that might signal faulty reasoning.
I'm feeling a lot more confident in my fallacy spotting skills now.
Excellent. Now that we've tackled these logical pitfalls, let's move on to some strategies for crafting compelling, ethical, and persuasive appeals.
All right, so we've talked about the types of persuasive arguments, we've learned how to organize them, and we've even explored those sneaky logical fallacies and how to dodge them. But it seems like there's got to be more to this whole persuasive speaking thing than just like pure logic, right?
You're absolutely right. Appealing to your audience's emotions can be just as important as appealing to their intellect.
Okay, I can see that, but how do you do that without seeming, I don't know, manipulative or like insincere?
It's all about striking that balance between authenticity and persuasion. One really powerful way to connect with your audience emotionally is through storytelling.
Oh, I love a good story. But how does that work in a persuasive speech?
Think of stories as a way to bring your arguments to life. Instead of just presenting dry facts and figures, you can weave those facts into a narrative that resonates with your audience's experiences and emotions.
So, like, if I'm giving a speech about the importance of funding arts education, I could start by sharing a personal story about how, like, music or theater impacted my own life.
Exactly. Or you could tell the story of a student who benefited from a really great arts program. Those stories, they create a human connection and help the audience see the issue in a more personal and meaningful way.
That makes sense.
Uh-huh.
Are there any other ways to, like, create that emotional connection?
Absolutely. The textbook talks about using really vivid language and imagery to kind of, like, paint a picture with your words.
So instead of just saying pollution is bad for the environment, I could say something like, imagine a world where the air is so thick with smog you can barely breathe, the rivers are choked with industrial waste.
Yes.
And the sounds of nature are completely drowned out by traffic.
That's a great example. You've created a much more visceral image.
Right.
That makes the impact of pollution much more real and immediate for the audience.
Wow, that's really powerful. What about using humor? Does that have a place in persuasive speaking?
Oh, absolutely. Humor can be a fantastic way to lighten the mood, make your message more engaging, and build a rapport with the audience.
But you wouldn't want to make light of, you know, a really serious topic, would you?
Right, exactly. It's all about finding that balance and using humor appropriately. A well-placed joke or a funny anecdote can make your speech more memorable and relatable, but you don't want to undermine the importance of your message.
So we've talked about appealing to emotions through stories, vivid language, humor. What else should we keep in mind?
The textbook also talks about the importance of framing and social proof.
Okay.
Framing basically means you're presenting your argument in a way that aligns with your audience's values and beliefs.
So instead of saying, we need to raise taxes to fund this program, I might say, we need to invest in our community's future by supporting this program.
Exactly. You're framing the issue in a way that resonates with their values, which makes them more likely to be receptive to your message.
Okay. What about social proof? What's that all about?
Social proof is all about highlighting how other people are already doing the thing you're advocating for.
Okay.
It kind of plays on that, you know, natural tendency to follow the crowd.
So if I'm trying to, like, persuade people to donate to a charity.
Yeah.
I could mention how many people have already donated.
Yes.
Or talk about the impact those donations have made.
Exactly. By showing that others are already on board, you're making it more likely that your audience will jump on that bandwagon too.
These are all really useful techniques.
Mm-hmm.
But there's got to be, like, a fine line between persuasion and manipulation, right? How can we make sure we're using these techniques ethically?
That is such an important point. Persuasion should always be about empowering the audience to make informed decisions.
Okay.
Not about coercing them into doing what you want.
So it's like being upfront about your goals.
Yes.
Presenting your arguments fairly.
Right.
And respecting your audience's intelligence.
Absolutely. Ethical persuasion is about building trust and fostering genuine dialogue.
Okay.
It's not about tricking people into agreeing with you.
Wow. This has been like a truly insightful deep dive into the whole world of persuasive speaking. I feel like I've gained a whole new understanding of the power of words and the responsibility that comes with using them well.
I'm so glad to hear that. And remember, persuasive speaking is a skill that takes practice. It's something you're always refining.
Right.
But with the knowledge and strategies you've learned in this deep dive, you're well on your way to becoming a more confident and compelling communicator.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us on this persuasive journey, everybody. We hope you've learned some valuable tips and techniques you can use in your own public speaking. Until next time, keep those minds open, those voices strong, and those arguments persuasive.